Hello, loyal listeners. Welcome back to the Football Diary Podcast. It's great to have you here. We're talking today more about continental games that have really taken our eye this week. So we're moving away from English football a little bit into potentially the Clásico first, I think, is probably the best place to start. So El Clásico in La Liga has been by far the biggest game in their league's history. But Real Madrid have kind of had a good run of it lately. But Barcelona, out of nowhere, have started putting together a really decent run of form under Xavi, which has culminated in a 4-0 hammering of Real Madrid, which, I've got to be honest, has taken me by surprise, and I think most people in the football world. So, Miles, I'll start there with you. I mean, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has been the catalyst, really, for this particular victory. He's settled in so well, hasn't he, at the Nou Camp? And I don't know, the impact that Xavi's had, bringing in players like him and Ferran Torres, has made all the difference. But 4-0 against Real Madrid, I didn't see that one coming, did you?
Definitely not. I mean, they're off the back of a good result against Galatasaray in the Europa League as well. They went 1-0 down in that game and looked like they might be about to bottle it, but showed that actually they've got a bit more steel than they had at the start of the season. We saw Barcelona really rocked before Xavi came in, and some of the signings that they've brought in over January have just clicked immediately. I think when you saw that the first name that they were bringing in was an aging Dani Alves, it didn't look like the most inspiring thing. But even he is playing a really good role in that team. But mainly Aubameyang, it's fantastic watching his form. In this game, he was incredible. And I think Xavi's really getting a good tune out of him and making him a better striker in some ways as well. Xavi, obviously, like quite famously a few years ago when Aubameyang was being linked with a move away from Dortmund, said that he wasn't the kind of striker you'd want at Barcelona because Barcelona like to operate around tight spaces and he looks for space behind. And that isn't the kind of striker he can imagine at the club. Now he's managing Barcelona, has brought exactly that striker to the club, and he looks brilliant. He's scoring goals, and his link-up play with the likes of Ferran Torres and also outcast Dembele, it's brilliant for them. So a really encouraging sign for Barcelona that although this season is probably a bit of a write-off, they're not going to push for the title now. The best thing they can hope for really is winning the Europa League and finishing potentially second, looking at how poor Sevilla's form's become recently. But it's a good sign for the future. Now, I don't think anyone thinks that Aubameyang was signed for the future of Barcelona, but Ferran Torres definitely is. If they can keep Dembele, he's another player that could continue to grow at the club. And of course, that midfield, Pedri, Frenkie de Jong, it is brilliant to see them developing. Some really good young players coming through. And that's not to mention Gabi as well, who looks fantastic. So it's really exciting for Barcelona to see them back to their best in this game, definitely, if not necessarily what we associate with Barcelona.
That's it. It's been a different setup, I think. And I expected Xavi to be a proper disciple of like the Guardiola way of playing, but he's kind of adapted to the players he's got and added a real sort of extra flair and an extra dimension to Barcelona that we haven't really seen before. So, Dave, if you could kind of sum up what's different about this Barcelona and how did they beat Real Madrid this time around so emphatically?
I think in terms of the team and picking on what Miles just said about Aubameyang and saying, obviously, you know, he doesn't operate in tight spaces. I think one of the positives and something he'll take from being in this Barcelona team is that Barcelona very much pick their moments of when they want to expose teams in certain areas, runs into channels. And the thing about Aubameyang, he always gets in the right positions to finish a move. And as we've seen, you know, over the last few weeks since he's come to the club and against Real Madrid, the two goals that he scored were typical, you know, Aubameyang sort of goals in those sort of the movement that he offered to get into those positions and finish were outstanding. But it's, you know, I don't know whether Real Madrid came into this game thinking, you know, we've got a healthy lead in the league. You know, Barcelona have looked a bit out of sorts. Barcelona haven't particularly played anyone of stature over the last couple of months. You know, since they kind of dropped out and into the Europa League, they beat a Napoli team that have been a little bit out of sorts of late. And I think there was probably a little bit of uncertainty there of what to expect, and I think they probably underestimated them. And you know, Barcelona, they they didn't look like a team that had just basically come under a new manager in the space of the last few weeks, 3 or 4 months. They've made such a transformation. It's almost unbelievable, really. And you know, you think of teams that are going through transitions. We've seen it as at first hand with teams, and the progress is made with this team. And when, you know, all of a sudden, a few months ago, Frankie de Jong, there was rumours that he was looking to get to leave. And they looked, you know, in all sorts of bother, Barcelona. And I'm sure there are a lot of clubs looking at some of those players and, you know, trying to get them elsewhere. But all of a sudden now, completely different scenario. And there's a lot of excitement that surrounds the club again. And I'm sure, it's a shame, really, there's such a gap between second and first, because Barcelona have so much momentum now. So many players in form. You speak about the likes of Dembele. He's scored, I think he's created, had more assists in Europe in 2022 than any other player. You know, you look at him, even though he's angling for a move away, that could be why he's picked up his form. He's looking for a big contract elsewhere. But all of a sudden, you know, there's so much positivity to look at. Real Madrid, like you mentioned, it was an off day for them. It was partly due to Barcelona being so good and partly due to Real Madrid being so bad. Obviously, we mentioned Benzema was a big absentee, but, you know, the midfield that they've got there is aging. They didn't look like there was energy in the legs of the players. They looked very immobile. Static is a word I'd describe them. But I mean, you can't discredit Barcelona. The goals that they scored were top quality.
Everything needs qualifying though with Barcelona when we talk about how much progress they're making with on the pitch. The progress is on the pitch. The club is still in an absolute state, and I'd be really interested to see how they go moving forward. Look at the signings that they've made that have made a massive influence. Very opportunistic signings. They're paying Adama Traore basically nothing. They got Dani Alves in on a free. They brought Aubameyang in on a free. So I am interested to see what their strategy is moving forward. They're trying to talk themselves into the Haaland case. And I don't know how that's possible when you look at the debt is still there. Nothing has changed off the field, really. As good as this performance was, and it's nice to see them playing good football again because they do have some quality players in the squad. I think we are overlooking a little bit what the scenario is and how they're going to get themselves out of that financial hole.
I don't really know where this money's coming from, because they've just signed Frank Kessie for the summer. On a free deal, and obviously there's going to be a signing on fee, and I imagine a big a big salary there. And they've been rumoured, you know, they've been linked with 2 or 3, 4 players over the last few days. You know, forward is ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You've got to hope that it's sustainable, first of all, I think, for the club, because they've made a lot of players make a lot of sacrifices financially, haven't they? They've taken pay cuts, or, you know, we've seen Messi move on and not accept a new deal because of the plight they were in. Yet they go and spend some serious money on wages, you'd imagine, on the players they've bought in. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, Miles. It does raise a few more questions about is everything okay off the field, and are they sustainable as a club still with these players on board, or are they trying to look for some kind of short-term fix? Hopefully, I mean,
they're
not.
So lucky that they produce some of the talents that they do. Because, you know, without that, they've been even more of a mess, and they're lucky that they have that system in place.
Well, there's the hope, really, that this 4-0 win isn't kind of a flash in the pan. I think that's what they need to kind of make sure that's not the case. And same with Real Madrid, really. They need to make sure that this is just a flash in the pan for them and that they can move on. A lot was made about Benzema's absence, but you'd expect some of the up-and-coming players to step up, wouldn't you, in his absence and kind of lead the front line, and they just didn't, really.
You would, but also it was a very odd selection as well, because his decision was, without Benzema, I'm going to basically play Modric up front, which Modric is an old man.
Well, that's what Man City can get away with like these four false nines playing up front together. They can't.
No, definitely not. Not someone like Luka Modric. And also the biggest problem with that is you then take Luka Modric out of your midfield when you're playing Barcelona, who want to play the entire game in midfield. So it was an odd decision from Ancelotti. It's safe to say as well.
There was a lot of criticism of his changes as well, because he wasn't really thinking forwards about how they can attack, and I think he excluded a lot of players that you'd expect to include when your back's against the wall. So like Isco never got a look in, obviously got Luka Jovic, they've got Gareth Bale, Eden Hazard, all this attacking talent, and they're persisting with the likes of Modric up front. I mean, they have got players like Camavinga still to come in and replace those aging legs in midfield, so you know they've got some good young talent, but for that particular game it was an odd selection, to say the least.
There's a couple of really good young midfielders there that I think they can be happy with the generation that's coming through. They've also got Federico Valverde as well, who I think is a very, very tidy midfielder. So once Casemiro, Modric and Toni Kroos eventually do move on, having Camavinga and him already in place, along with inevitable investment, I mean, they obviously, it looks like Mbappe is there and Haaland could potentially join, which would just be frightening, really. If you can sign the likes of Mbappe and Haaland for a combined 80 million transfer fee, that is European powerhouse sort of stuff, really. And the difference with Real Madrid is they look like they've got the infrastructure and strategy and mentality that they could make that a winning team. If that was at PSG, you'd think, well, okay, it's too many strikers. But I don't know. I don't think Real Madrid have to worry about it too much after this game, to be honest. They're going to win the title quite comfortably. They're still in the Champions League. Benzema will come back. I think he'd be fine.
Well, there's question marks over Carlo Ancelotti, really, as well. I know he's got a lot of kind of credit to his name because he's such a legend of the club, and he won La Decima, didn't he, to break that duck for them. But there's kind of a question mark in the Spanish media, especially the Madrid media, saying, you know, maybe he's past his best now. Maybe Real Madrid need a fresh focus from a younger up-and-coming coach, and is he the kind of person to lead this next generation of Real Madrid superstars? Because he made some really strange choices in this game. I mean, he hooked, was it Carvajal at halftime and put Mariano on, who's barely played much football this season. And yeah, it was baffling to say the least. And he's not really managed those, you know, aging superstars that aren't getting a look in very well either. So even if he wanted to get a tune out of Bale, Isco, Eden Hazard, he's pretty much slated them in the press and said their days are numbered at Real Madrid. So it's not the best man management either for them, when you could have called upon them, really. It's such a shame.
Isco is a really sad one as well. I really liked watching Isco play. And at Malaga, he was absolutely outstanding. And when he first joined Real Madrid, he was electric. I don't really know what's gone wrong for him over the last couple of seasons, but he's just not even in the picture anymore.
No. But yeah, like you say, the La Liga title race is... It's kind of wrapped up, isn't it? I mean, they're, what, 6 points clear of Sevilla. I think Barca have got a game in hand, but that still brings them to only within 6 points. 9 points even, actually. It's nine, isn't it?
Yeah, it is nine.
Of Real Madrid. So they've got some points to drop to lose that massive lead. But I guess maybe you've got to hope that for next season there's some positive signs for the league to be a bit more competitive, maybe.
Yeah, potentially, I guess. I don't know. Like I say, I can see Real Madrid investing very heavily in the summer. I don't know if Barcelona will have the capability to do that. Sevilla look like they're going to fall off massively. They look so... The West Ham result was such a shame for them, because they were obviously hoping to win another Europa League title, particularly in their own stadium where the final will be. But yeah, I think Real Madrid are quite comfortable right now, to be honest, in Spain. And Atletico, even, their investment strategy is just so bizarre these days that they're just signing the same player eight times and hoping it will work. But I can't see them catching Real Madrid anytime soon either.
So, yeah, a bit of a refresh needed. And like I said with Ancelotti, they've got, obviously, Simeone still at Atletico. I mean, he's got so much favour to his name, but maybe it's time for a bit of change at Atletico as well. They've got players with some immense talent that they could really flex. So who knows whether he'll still be around. But moving on to other European leagues. Well, one in particular, Miles, I'm going to jump into Serie A. And the highlight in Italy of the last week was quite clear. Do you want to talk us through what that is and what we're talking about?
Well, it depends whether it's what we're talking about or who we're talking about, because really all the credit's got to go to two main people, I think. But we are talking, obviously, about Roma winning the Rome Derby very convincingly. A lovely 3-0 win. And really, the star of the show was Tammy Abraham is brilliant. He's having such a strong season at Roma. He's obviously just broken the record for the most goals in a debut season at Roma, beating the likes of Battistuta, Montella. And it's not even finished yet. He looks like he's only just hitting his top form as well. He's been absolutely fantastic. And I have to say, I think the motivation behind that is the man in the dugout. I think Mourinho's been fantastic for him. Abraham has developed a really strong relationship with him. He's talked quite openly about how when he goes to training, he feels like he's in the presence of a superstar because Mourinho is there still, even. He says quite candidly that he wasn't really sure about the move to Roma. It wasn't something that he'd ever thought about. But Mourinho called him and immediately he was like, yeah, I want to be a part of this project. So it's working slightly. If you look at Roma's recent form, it's the most Mourinho-style form you'll ever see. 1-0 late win, 1-0 late win, 1-0, 1-0, 1-0. Like, and then this game, Mourinho was up for it. You could tell he just really wanted to win the Rome derby because I don't think it's understood what that means in Italy in particular for the Rome derby. It is huge. Not like any kind of derby I think we have in England, if I'm 100% honest. I don't think there's a derby in England that comes anywhere close to it. It is massive for the city, and particularly this season, I think, where neither team are in the title race. It's unlikely that either team will make the top four now, but they're very close in the league. This is your bragging rights, and Mourinho went all in on winning the Roma fans over with this. He slated Lazio in the build-up, he slated Sarri and the players, and then they started the game with such intensity that Lazio couldn't get settled. Abraham scored the fastest ever Rome derby goal in Serie A as well in this game. And it was fantastic to watch. I thought he set up perfectly. I really enjoyed this game.
So many landmarks for him as well, because, I mean, like you say, he's the best debut season for Roma since those, you know, illustrious players in their history. So that itself is just an amazing achievement. But he's the first Englishman to reach 14 goals in Serie A for 60 years. Which is insane. He's the second English player to net in a Rome derby after Paul Gascoigne. So there's a few kind of things he's standing out for. And you've got to kind of sit up and pay attention to him. I think he's also the second highest goal scorer in the top five leagues behind the one and only Lewandowski in the Bundesliga. So in terms of how prolific he is this year, he's definitely stepped up to another level. But in terms of England as well, surely he's the most informed English striker now, Dave, right? I mean, he's even sort of surpassing Harry Kane's feats recently because he had a slow start to this season.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it'd be interesting if Harry Kane hadn't, you know, picked up in form to see what would kind of unfold. But Southgate being Southgate, I can't see him, you know, dropping Kane for Abraham. He's such a... he loves his favourites And to be fair to Kane, he's performed really well the last few games and looked more like his old self. But yeah, Tammy Abraham, I think a lot will probably be surprised of how well he has adapted to the league and how fruitful he's been performing in terms of, you know, his goals. And we've known he's so good in those certain areas in the penalty box. He's never struggled, and he showed that even in his time under Lampard at Chelsea. It was only until Tuchel came in and he stopped playing and he stopped getting those opportunities. And fair play to him, he's obviously looked for a new opportunity, a new challenge, and you can't really ask any more from him. He's performed so well, and he definitely deserves a chance with England. 100%. He's a different kind of striker to Harry Kane, in my opinion. Harry Kane likes to drop deep, obviously link play, and if you want somebody kind of spearheading that attack, then there's nobody better, really. And I think, you know, it's different. Obviously, a lot of England fans won't have seen a lot of him, obviously being in Serie A. And, you know, a lot of fans that watch Premier League. So I think he deserves the opportunity to show what he can do.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange because Lukaku was the one that Chelsea signed because how good he did in Serie A. Mm. And they got rid of Abraham to make way for him. But it's just turned out so differently for both of them, hasn't it? But Miles, you're going to say a bit more on Tammy?
It's just a shame because obviously he's dropped out of this England squad now with injury. Mm-hmm. And really, this is a good platform for him to try and build on. But I think if you know that you're playing second fiddle to Harry Kane, but you could go back to Roma, help them try and push for fourth, but also win that Conference League. I know we laugh at it a bit as a title, but winning the first season of that and spearheading the Roma attack that does it would be fantastic for him to pick a trophy up early. The thing that I really hope is that he holds on there for a little bit, because there is already talk of him being linked with a move to England again. Chelsea have an 80 million buyback in the summer, which you can't imagine they'll be able to exercise, or whether they will or not, with Lukaku still on their books. But there's massive talk that Man United and Arsenal have already made inquiries about him, and Roma have turned around today and said, okay, 100 million. And I love that, because that is a sign of determination from Roma that we've kind of lapped over the last few years. When you look at how easy it was to move players like Alisson, Salah, Rudiger, they've all moved on really easily to Premier League clubs with money. Now, Roma have got these new owners. They've brought Mourinho in. They've spent money on Tammy Abraham after already buying another number nine, by the way, in Shmorodov, who can't get a look in anymore because Abraham's form is so good. I really hope he persists with this project, because if you look at the likes of him, Fikayo Tomori at AC Milan, who's having an outstanding season, but still overlooked by England somehow. It's really nice to see that this platform is there for these players to progress, a bit like the Bundesliga has been for some young English players over the last few years. Right. I've always loved Tammy Abraham, obviously from his time at Villa. I was gutted when we weren't more in the conversation to try and bring him back, to be honest. But now I see him at Roma, and I think he's got such a level there that if Roma can get back into the Champions League, if not this season, next season, which I think Mourinho will be pushing for, it'd be great to see what he can achieve at that level. But to be honest, there is one other hero of the Rome team this season that really deserves a mention, and that's Lorenzo Pellegrini. He's been incredible. It's his best season for Roma by some distance, and his goal in this game was just phenomenal. Now, letting people behind the curtain a little bit, we're recording this on Thursday night, just before Italy play their World Cup playoff, and he's not in the Italian starting 11, and it's absolutely criminal. It's just come out, I've looked, and I'm gutted for him, because he's the sort of player that I would build a team around at the moment, because Roma are doing it and it is working for them. And when Italy are missing the likes of Chiesa, Immobile has never really inspired that much in attack. Insigne is on very bad form at the moment with his move to Canada kind of lurking. Pellegrini, to me, should be one of the first names on the team sheet. And Mourinho has put a lot of faith in him, and you can tell he's another one where Mourinho feels like he's on the pitch. He's his leader. And I love that with him. He's been outstanding this season, and I really hope that continues too.
Well, I think that's one of the things that Mourinho will probably use as fuel for those players to play better, you know, screw your country. They obviously don't think much of you. Go and prove them wrong. And probably said the same to Tammy when he came over, you know, Chelsea did want you. I know what your worth is. So go and prove everybody wrong. And that has kind of worked, hasn't it? I mean, what is the Mourinho way now? From what you've seen, Miles, in Italy this season, what's his method? What's his mind games? Has it changed much? Has he adapted it? And how has Italy received him second time around?
He's loved in Italy. He's absolutely loved in Italy. And the Roma fans have really, really taken to him. And I think the way that he plays the press has kind of helped that, particularly with this derby. He said coming into the derby, someone asked him, are you nervous about the fact that you're playing on Thursday and then Sunday you've got the Rome derby with Lazio will have a bigger rest? And he said, no, it's perfect preparation for my players to be playing tonight while Lazio's players are at home smoking with Sarri. So the Roma fans love stuff like that, of course. And along with that, I think it's very easy to buy into the character. But on the pitch, over the last sort of 7 or 8 games where Roma have looked a lot more solid, you can see Mourinho again. Like I said, the form table is 1-0, 1-0, 1-1, 1-0, 1-1. So it is very organised, efficient performances. And a few times he's kind of relied on what kind of quality he has on the bench in some very young players as well that he's bringing through. Roma have got an excellent academy. Their youth team have been brilliant over the last few years. And Mourinho has maybe had to lean on them a little bit because it's not the deepest squad. And I think it bothers me because the UK press still talk about Mourinho a lot, obviously. And they go, oh, Mourinho's only playing young players to try and sent a message to the board to bring in more funds, and Almirini has just happened to get a result by bringing on a couple of subs. If that was any other manager, it would be, this manager is really developing the young side of this team, and this manager made brilliant tactical changes that's getting results. But Roma don't care. They're happy to just go about their business. Sadly, it took a little while to get into gear, and they're probably out of the top four conversation. I can't see them catching Juventus at this stage, with Juventus kind of kicking on in form as well. But there's really positive signs for next season. And if they invest properly in the summer, it will be fantastic. This game was in a bit of an anomaly. They were really intense in this game and really attacking, because I think that they knew they could take the game to Lazio early and kill it. And they just did. The early goal obviously changes everything. Once you score a minute in, everyone's game plan changes. And then they got the second goal really quickly as well. And the game was done, basically. Lazio looked awful, I thought. They were so unresponsive. It was really, really poor.
Which is some statement, really, considering they're literally right next to each other in the table, chasing the same goals, really. So I think Roma have definitively proved where they're at in quality, which is, you know, it's better late than never, but it's nice to see it coming to some kind of fruition, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Forza Roma, they're absolutely lifting the city at the moment, and I really look forward to what's to come. It's exciting to see young players breaking through and what that might mean for next season. And this was a performance without Zaniolo, who I think would have been a lot of people's pick as their most entertaining and exciting player coming into this season. So they have got a few players still to come back in that they can lean on. And I think Mourinho's looks like he's really enjoying his time out there. And I hope that that's not just a two good seasons, one catastrophe kind of thing again.
Yeah. Italy, really interesting as well, because their title race is still very much a title race.
Yeah.
And I think you can even say maybe Juventus is still kind of an outside bet.
Maybe.
For the title. There's a bit of a gap there. But even behind them in the chasing pack, you've got obviously Roma, Atalanta, Lazio, Fiorentina, all kind of very similarly positioned. So yeah, it's competitive and actually tighter than the Premier League. So Italy's looking positive, really, as a league to watch, and it's pretty entertaining. There's goals there, and we've said this already, and you said it in your sort of Serie A spotlights. It's a league to kind of watch now, and that old kind of stereotype of it being defensive has gone out the window a little bit, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think when we saw the summer's business and a lot of players moving on, the wonder was going to be where the spotlight would fall within the league. And actually what it's done is it's even things out really nicely. It's a really competitive league, like you say. Now, it does look like AC Milan are becoming favourites, because Inter Milan have dropped their form. Napoli are still really in the conversation, though. But a lot of the players that are spearheading those teams are really young as well. So there's potential for real growth. If you look at Lautaro Martinez at Inter Milan, Rafael Leao and players like that at AC Milan, Victor Osimhen at Napoli, and Tammy Abraham at Roma, Vlahovic at Juventus. These are players that are leading attacks at young ages that are competing with each other. And that could go on for a really long time, which would make the league fantastic. I really hope that is the case anyway.
Yeah, I think it's good for Italy to have some momentum in their league as a competition after the success at the Euros as well, which brings me on kind of nicely to the World Cup qualifiers, where it's actually still on a real knife edge, isn't it? So Italy have got the small matter of North Macedonia to get past before they even face the potential final tie of their route to the World Cup, which is Portugal or Turkey. So most likely Portugal. It's baffling to think that one of either Portugal or Italy are not going to make it to this World Cup, because they're both such elite teams, but that's a very real prospect. Dave, have you seen kind of much of the form of these teams going into the World Cup qualifiers? And how do you see Italy's kind of progress as the European champions? Can you see them missing out potentially on being in a World Cup so soon after triumphing?
I mean, it's difficult to look past that as a matchup, isn't it, really? Italy, Portugal. But I mean, in their last few games, Portugal were an absolute mess. It was diabolical in some of the performances they put in. I think, in a way, coming, going back to the league campaign actually did them a big favour, because it took a lot of the spotlight off of their national team. Obviously, players returning to their clubs. But now it's crunch time, and I'm sure that, their key players will have to be back on form, because it won't be an easy game. It won't be an easy tie, I don't feel. And I don't feel as though Portugal have shown any real consistency in this campaign to suggest that they'll wipe the floor with Turkey and make it an easy match. So I think if it is Portugal that goes through, against Italy. I'd fancy Italy as the favourites, just going off of obviously how they did obviously in the Euros. It would definitely be an interesting game, and obviously plenty of, you know, brilliant players to watch in that tie. It would be such a good game. So an exciting one. Let's hope that they both get through and, you know, that transpires. But as we know with football, that's not always the case.
It's a real strange one because small margins have stopped Italy from qualifying automatically. The competitiveness of the group stages of these World Cup qualifiers was intense. And I think it was Switzerland that went through, wasn't it, in their group? And I'm sure they drew a game against each other where, again, if that was a win, that would have been Italy through. So
it was how tight it was. Closer than that. Both games, Jorginho missed penalties. And if he'd scored either of them, I think Italy were through. And Jorginho missing a penalty is a pretty rare thing in itself. So for it to have happened twice, it's heartbreaking for Italy.
Do you know what? If they didn't qualify now, looking back at those moments, they'd be kicking themselves, wouldn't they? But small margins at this level. Portugal, on the other hand, I think if Ronaldo didn't make it to this competition, that would be his last shot at a major tournament, wouldn't it? Unless he just keeps on going, which is insane to believe, isn't it? But surely they can get past Turkey. Turkey that I remember from the Euros, absolutely terrible. But yet here they are on the verge of a World Cup, maybe qualification.
I'm so conflicted in this, as I'm sure you can imagine, because I absolutely love Italy. I want them at the World Cup. I always want to see Italy at the World Cup. But the idea of Ronaldo never playing in a World Cup again also really pains me because I just think he's phenomenal. But it's not guaranteed that Portugal will get through this tie. As good as their squad is, and it is bizarre that they're not there already. Because on paper, Portugal's squad should be World Cup winners, like, or contenders at least. If you think about the quality that they've got now, just within the Premier League, even some of the Portuguese players that we're familiar with, it is outstanding. And even their defence has sorted itself out with the likes of João Cancelo, Nelson Semedo, Ruben Dias. There's some Rafael Guerreiro at Dortmund. There's some brilliant players. But in this tie against Turkey, they're missing everyone. All of a sudden, they're playing. I've just seen the lineup. They're playing José Font at centre-back. Yeah. Pepe's not playing because he's got COVID. Otherwise, he would be playing still, Pepe. Wow. Instead, they're playing Danilo Pereira, the PSG holding midfielder at centre-back. And Diogo Dalo is playing at right-back for them. They're missing Cancelo through suspension. Diaz is injured. Pepe's got COVID. Ruben Neves has dropped out of the squad as well. So João Moutinho is still playing in centre midfield for them as well. So it's brilliant when you hear all those names and you think then you've got the attacking talents of Bruno Fernandes, João Felix, Adrian Silva, Bernardo Silva, Jota, Rafael Leão, and that's not even mentioning Ronaldo. It's inconceivable that Portugal won't be at the World Cup with a squad like that. But then on the other hand, you have the current European champions who, again, have got their own wealth of talent, an incredibly good manager. And despite the fact that they've not qualified, they've still only lost one in the last 40 games.
That's so crazy.
It's a great record. It is. That game will be incredible if it is those two. But Portugal have to get through Turkey first. And with the leaky defence that they're likely to have in this game with the players they've got missing, I cannot understand. Maybe they have and he said no. I cannot understand why no one's made a call to Ezri Konsa. Because he has Portuguese heritage and it doesn't look like he's anywhere near the England team yet. And that is exactly the sort of defender that Portugal could do with right now. Just want to put your body on the line.
Exactly. 39.
Sorry?
I think Jose Font's like 38, 39 now.
Yeah. And him and Pepe would be first choice centre backs with Ruben Dias, which is just incredible. I think Bruno Alves probably isn't that far off a call up again. Or
but just a word on Italy then. What kind of lineup are we expecting from them against North Macedonia? Have you seen the lineup for them tonight? Has that been released?
Yeah. So obviously they're missing Chiellini and Bonucci. So it is Mancini. And I think it's Bastone, who's having a really good season.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. But they're obviously still without Spinazzola as well. So Emerson is in. The real thing for Italy is who's going to get the goals, because Immobile is still flattering to deceive when it comes to international football. He's got... Of course, he's got Belotti there as an option as well. but again, not really ever done it in an Italy shirt. And then the one that I really want to see come on is João Pedro, because I think he's probably the one that could get the goals for Italy. A bit more dynamic, a bit more of a technical footballer, and not really tainted with any previous with the country. Lorenzo Insigne is the one that really bothers me, because he's such a phenomenal footballer, and he's made this weird decision that he's going to move to Toronto at the end of the season. And since then, his form has dropped off a cliff. And Berardi's in the team as well. And I cannot understand why you wouldn't put Lorenzo Pellegrini in there. I would have loved to have seen Pellegrini. I would have loved to have seen Zaniolo, maybe a bit biased, I know, but I think that's kind of where Italy needs to be without Federico Chiesa. And the other one that I think all football fans will be gutted about is no Mario Balotelli. He got into he was invited into the training camp in January. Mancini has talked about how good his form has been in Turkey, and he kind of wants to see him come back in. And he didn't make the squad, and I think a lot of people will be disappointed that we don't have Super Mario maybe trying to go for him.
I think Immobile's just been so uninspiring for Italy whenever I've seen him play. And
it's absolutely bizarre. His form in Serie A since he rejoined Lazio, like, he is absolutely fantastic. I think he's got a goal ratio per game of like 0.75 or something like that, and it's half of that with Italy. He's just shot of confidence in a national team shirt. We've seen it at England. It happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. The national team shirt just weighs heavy on some players, and Immobile seems like he's one of those. And it is a shame, because domestically he's a world-class footballer, but he just cannot perform for the country. And now is the time to do it. He is starting tonight. So I don't know. We could all look really stupid by the time this podcast is actually available. The games are probably finished, and North Macedonia have won 5-0, and Turkey have embarrassed Portugal, and this whole conversation was pointless.
No way back for Moise Kean then in the Italy setup. He seemed like the bright thing at one point, didn't he?
Not in the squad now. Obviously, he went back to Juventus, but with Vlahovic being reintroduced, Alvaro Morata already there, he's not really done anything for Juve. And it is a shame, because you are right. There's a couple of them. If you remember, at one point, it was Moise Kean and Patrick Cotrone before he made that move to Wolves. Those two looked like they were going to be like mainstays in the Italian national team. And yeah, it's just not really happened. Instead, all the limelight's gone to Chiesa instead. And with him injured, no Bonucci, no Chiellini. It's not plain sailing for Italy or Portugal, really. But let's all hope that both of them get there at least, because it'd be fantastic to see that playoff. Yeah. Everything on the line.
Bit of uncertainty elsewhere in the fixtures, obviously, with the situation in Ukraine. Scotland's game against them is postponed. And of course, Poland probably most likely get a bye against the Football Union of Russia, as they are now called, on all the fixture lists. So, yeah, some strange sort of things to decide there and how that plays out. Sweden, Czech Republic is another one, and Wales, Austria. So a few ties there that are still worth noting. So fascinating still to come. But before we leave, guys, I just want to touch on some domestic football, and for Dave actually to chime in on the situation at Manchester United. So a lot of talk about Erik ten Hag being the next Manchester United manager, almost being sort of confirmed and wrapped up, and leaks galore again within Manchester United. But it seems like it's coming from credible sources. Where are we at with that? Is ten Hag now the likely candidate? And how can we know that's any kind of truth to that?
Well, I think it speaks volume that a couple of nights ago we had this breaking news initially from the, I think it was the Daily Mail, and that there had been talks, official talks, an interview on Monday, this past Monday, that with obviously Ten Hag had with the club. And it seemed that a lot of other journalists followed suit, and it was virtually confirmed that this was the case. And I just think it's quite strange that, you know, the news, this bigger news, is virtually leaked to a couple of journalists who, you know, then it kind of circulates. And I just think it's very strange for a club to leak this information if, you know, that if that man isn't the favourite for that, you know, the role at the club. So it seems as though he's a favourite, going off of what's been mentioned. We've seen stories over the last couple of weeks. Pochettino sort of distanced himself with a job, and that apparently he wants to stay at PSG and win the job with them. I don't know whether that's sort of saving face and whether he's actually kind of come to realization that, you know, Ten Hag is the favourite for the job, and he's kind of in, he's hit a wall really, and he's trying to kind of solidify his position at PSG. And what I've read is that PSG are reluctant to sack Pochettino because I think it's going to cost them 17 million to sack him and his staff in total. So I think they're kind of obviously reluctant to do that, and they're looking to for him to basically hand his resignation in. If it's kind of looking like it's coming to an end, really, with that, whether he will see out, you know, is the remainder of his contract, and he'll have another season there. And but it does seem as though it's not working there, is it?
It's strange, isn't it?
It's bizarre. Like, Pochettino will not be at PSG next season. I think you're right, Dave. I think they're waiting to see if Man United make an offer so they won't have to pay the severance. As soon as United announce who their next manager is, if it's not Pochettino, it's going to be sacked. They lost 3-0 to Monaco at the weekend, and it was just embarrassing. The game before that, Neymar and Messi are getting booed every time they touch the ball. This game, they just fell apart. They were getting players booked for dissent. Monaco tore them apart. Pochettino is not liked there anymore by the hierarchy. That's not going to last, but... Is Ten Hag the right man?
For me, I feel as though he's a risk. I feel that's the same with Pochettino, though. I think you can say the argument for me is you bring Pochettino in, and is he a better manager than Klopp? Is he a better manager than Guardiola? No, he's not.
And is it available, though?
You can have a worse manager, but you've got to have the players to you know, make up for that. Mm. We don't have the players to you know, to make that jump. And at the end of the day, from what we've seen from Ten Hag and his two teams that he's built under Ajax, you know, we saw that great team that obviously went out in the semi-final to Tottenham, the likes of Van der Beek, obviously Ziyech, all of these players left the club, De Ligt, left the club, and he had to build another team. And the football that they play is, you know, it's so easy on the eye, brilliant to watch. And some of the statistics that, you know, he's thrown up this season, they've conceded 10 goals in the league. Mm. Their goal difference is something like 70 odd. It's absolutely ridiculous. And we could talk about the Eredivisie, you know, not being the strongest league, but the title race is still on. That's a
they're not guaranteed.
PSV are doing really well as well, so that'll be one to keep an eye on. But for me, I feel as though he is the right choice, just because I feel as though our the manager, I feel like, will be a risk, but I feel like he has the best upside potential.
I think United are also shopping in a different market now. I think for players and for managers now, they can't go for the elite because there's nothing on offer from Manchester United at the moment. Might even not even be Champions League football. So who are the best coaches in the world? They're all at our rivals. They're not going to move to us. Tuchel potentially might have his head turned if Chelsea doesn't work out. But then you're looking at Nagelsmann at Bayern. Why is he going to leave Bayern Munich for Manchester United right now? You're looking at Mancini with Italy. Maybe they could keep their eyes open for something disastrous happening there, and you never know. But other than that, we're looking at up and coming. We're looking at potential next legendary managers, and I think Ten Hag is one of those. I think he's one of those that will be at a top club, if not Manchester United, then somewhere else.
The thing you've got to ask yourselves is, if Guardiola or Klopp were to leave tomorrow, would Pochettino be getting interviewed by Liverpool or Manchester City? Probably not.
No, the thing is, though, I think Mike's hit the nail on the head there, that the problem is, you talk about trying to bring in an elite manager. There aren't any right now. The age of elite managers is quite low because the cycle is really
short. There's another one out there there is one more out there that, you know, is unavailable, but United have been linked with as well, and that's Luis Enrique at Spain, and he's already been made that his intentions, you know, he's fully focused on the job until the World Cup's over and done with. And I feel like he would be a manager. If Guardiola was to leave, I feel like he'd be perfect for Manchester City.
Well, the problem is, you see every club recycle their manager within 3 years now. So no one really has the opportunity to build the legacy that Klopp did at Dortmund or Guardiola did at Barcelona to build that reputation. So we don't know who the world-class managers are at this stage. But Ten Hag, for me... how many players have we seen move from the Dutch league over to the Premier League and it just doesn't stick because the standard of football is so different? Developing a young Ajax team who have all been brought up with the same footballing philosophy and played through the youth system together, and then managing a load of 18-year-olds that are really proud to play for their club in a league that isn't very competitive is a completely different job to coming in and then trying to manage Bruno Fernandes, Cristiano Ronaldo, Paul Pogba if he's still there, and competing with the likes of Klopp and Guardiola on a regular basis. Now, yeah, he had a decent run in the Champions League that year. I do think a lot of that is coming up against the unknown. You don't really know what to expect of an Ajax team in the Champions League, and a lot of things worked in their favour there. But this whole idea of this up-and-coming coach worries me that it's actually a manager who is 52. He's older than Pochettino, which I think a lot of people are overlooking, and has won 2 Dutch titles and 2 cups in Holland. I don't think that there's enough to make me look at him and think he will be the guy that brings Man United back into the title conversation. You've missed the opportunity to get Conte in. So now, if it were me, apparently the talk is that there are 4 interview candidates. It was Ten Hag, Luis Enrique, Pochettino and Lopetegui. I'm not inspired by any of them, to be honest.
I think one thing that Ten Hag has got going for him is his trajectory has been, you know, constantly upwards. You look at, obviously, Pochettino, his last job, I can only see it going against him, really, with what he's had to handle. And you mentioned there, your argument there, Miles, egos to manage. You know, Pochettino coming to United, he's in exactly the same position.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Whereas, you know, I think the thing is, you're always going to say that about managers that haven't had the opportunity. And, you know, Ten Hag has worked under Guardiola. He was his assistant at Bayern Munich.
Yeah.
Went to FC Utrecht. Both his 2 seasons there, he bettered the first season in his second season. And, you know, he's gone to Ajax. He's done brilliantly there. You look at the players that have come from the Premier League, in Tadic, and obviously from Southampton, and Haller, who's one of the top scorers in the Champions League this year. Mm. You know, you can't really argue with that. And
but then they've just been knocked out to the Benfica side that you wouldn't have expected to take them out there.
But you look at that game, Ajax were massively the better team in that. You watched the game, I saw quite a bit of it, and they were dominant. And yeah, fair enough. Obviously, they went out in that, but you've got to look at the campaign itself. You know, their group stage, they absolutely dominated that group stage.
Yeah,
in a competitive group. So I feel as though he's a risk, but I feel like United aren't in a position to, you know, to be picky with. I feel like they need to take a risk, and I feel like it'll be worth the opportunity. And if out of the selection of those managers, like you mentioned, the choices there, I think he's got to be up there, and I'll probably take Enrique if I could, but that's not realistic.
I agree. I think Enrique would be the ideal. I really do, for his pedigree and his philosophy. But I think Ten Hag is the one that's more realistic for United right now. But even so, whoever takes charge has got a lot of surgery to do on that squad. So you've got to stick by them, whoever it is. And I think need to kind of accept maybe a season or so of uncertainty next year for them. While they start picking away at some of the dead wood, maybe signing some players that fit a new philosophy. Like you said, Miles, on a few pods, there's a few, 5 different coaches worth of players at United at the moment, stretching back to like Louis van Gaal and David Moyes even. There's still one matter at the club, which is mental. So there are a few players there from different philosophies. So there's a lot of question marks over whoever does take charge. Will they be given the time to rebuild? And they have to be given the time. And I think that's probably where someone like Ten Hag has got no pressure on him.
Linking back to our conversation with this pod, though, to me, I still go back to they probably should have never sacked Mourinho. I honestly believe that. I don't think I would have got rid of Jose. I think they did.
I think a lot of things Mourinho criticised the club for have definitely come to fruition massively. Yeah,
I think he was 100% right. And if you give him this squad now, I think he does a much better job. He wanted Harry Maguire, who, all right, is a bit rubbish, but he didn't get him, and then the club brought him in. If you gave him Ronaldo now, I think he'd be getting a lot more out of him. It's bizarre to me. I know he had that fallout with Luke Shaw, and I know that some of the performances weren't the most inspiring to me. He's kind of the perfect manager for Man United right now, just sort out the issues if you let him. But United don't want a manager that wants to sort the issues out. They want a manager that's going to go, yeah, okay, I'll do whatever you say.
Blimey, what a note to finish the podcast on. Mourinho was right. There we were.
he deserves it this week. That's what I think.
I think, well, the way Roma have performed as well, I think the way we've kind of waxed lyrical about Roma's performance, yeah, he's probably increased his stock considerably since those days. So maybe you've got a point, mate. But that's all we've got time for now. Great talking to you guys. Nice to focus on something other than the Premier League for once, actually. Yeah. It's been refreshing. Next time out, we'll probably focus more on the games that are happening in the playoffs and see how they've panned out, because that's happening as we speak tonight. But then also, we've got England games to look at as well, albeit friendlies, but we'll see how the players there have performed that Gareth Southgate's given a chance to. So there might be something interesting to discuss there. Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, thank you for your time again, guys. Thank you once again for watching. And please do hit subscribe, follow, like, wherever you are listening to or watching the podcast today. That'd be much appreciated. Thank you very much. See you soon, guys.
Cheers. Thanks.